This last Friday, Joseph Goldstein, who you may know as one of the founders of the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, gave a talk in San Francisco to benefit San Francisco Zen Center, and in preparation for introducing him, I downloaded a bunch of stuff from his website, including some interviews, and they're very interesting, and you might want to check it out. I think it's under dharma.org. I may quote a few things from him. One of the things that he emphasizes is that he's just beginning to notice from his own practice that when he goes back and studies the Pali Canon, for example, or whatever he may be studying in the Buddha Dharma, he sees how much emphasis is put on the mind that does not cling. That he quoted Ajahn Chah as saying, if you let go a little, you have a little peace. If you let go more, you have more peace. And when you let go completely, then all your struggles are over. Of course, much easier said than done. But a good deal of what we do as we practice is to notice, what do we cling to? What is it that we grasp? We talk so much about grasping self or a view of self. But I think when you... And any time you're grasping, there is a self there. And so it's a very interesting way of studying the self. You know, the great Zen teacher, the founder of the school of which I'm a part, Soto Zen, Dogen Zenji, says to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awakened by everything. It's sort of the same thing, you know. When you let go of all self-clinging, then you're free. This is liberation. The great Zen teacher, the third ancestor in China, wrote a poem called On Trusting Mind, or On Believing Mind. It begins, the way, great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Right. We have preferences. To the degree that we have preferences, to the degree that we cling to what is pleasant and are averse to what is unpleasant, we're not free. To the degree that we can rest in what is, we can make our home right here, right now, in things as it is. To that degree, we are free. I think you might recognize that this is a long road. Somebody asked Joseph a question Friday night, and he said, "Well, yeah, you start by noticing sounds, sights, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects. You start by, and he goes through all of these things, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then, then you see that everything is empty, and there is nothing to cling to." And I said, "Joseph, shouldn't you mention that that's some years that you're talking about?" Because he sort of went through it in about a minute, you know. So that people don't get discouraged. But as Ajahn Chah says, when you let go a little, you have a little peace. So each time we let go of something that we're clinging to, there is more ease in our life. And each time we notice that, it's easier the next time we find ourselves clinging to loosen our grip. So that we practice noticing. We practice paying attention to, where do I get caught? Where is my mind caught with preferences? Until we see that in action, it's really hard to notice that we're doing it. We're just feeling kind of stuck in the situation. And don't notice that our mental process is what's getting us stuck. We have a tremendous amount of conditioning that leads us to believe that there is a real something here that we can identify with that's called Blanche. You know, just like when we look up in the sky and we see some stars up there and we say, that's the Big Dipper. No, I'm pointing in the wrong direction. There, okay. That's, well, I bet everybody in this room has looked up at these particular stars and said, that's the Big Dipper, right? I mean, is there anyone who hasn't? Is there a Big Dipper up there? Or are there some stars of which we have added the mental construct Big Dipper? So that we always see it when we look in that part of the sky. And that's sort of what happens with this self, you know. We have this mental construct of a permanent fixed entity called a self, called whatever your name is, with which we identify. And we think it's real, just like we kind of think the Big Dipper is really the Big Dipper. The more we can see through that, the less we are caught by it. I think you will notice any time a strong emotion arises, check it out. Next time, let's say, anger arises. Is there a thought in your mind that contains either I, me, or mine, that contains some personal pronoun referring to this one? How dare they do that to me? Or, don't they know who I am? Or, that's mine. Or, I don't know, check it out. When anger arises, to see if there isn't some concept of self that is in the center of that emotional upset. And to the degree that we can see through that idea of self as a mental construct, to that degree, we will have some freedom from the mental upset that comes when something seems to impinge on the boundaries that we have established that defines what is this self. I was once rather a radical feminist, or at least a pretty combative feminist, pretty vocal in speaking up for proper respect for the gender that I identify with, which I felt was not treated with equal respect as the gender that I disidentified with. You know, because I didn't just think of myself as a woman. I thought of myself as a woman, like, I am a woman, that is not a man. You know, there was a very dualistic way in which I thought of myself as a woman. And one day I had this insight that to think of myself as a woman, particularly in that way, but to think of myself as a woman was limiting this, whatever it is, to the less than the totality of what it is. It was making some boundary that I was making with my mind that was not a boundary that I needed to make. And in fact, that insight kind of grew to include any definition that I make of myself creates a boundary that limits this, whatever this may be, to less than the totality of whatever it is. And indeed, in Zen practice, one of the things we do is sometimes is just sit with this question, what is this, I wonder? What is this? You know, I think it's me, but what really, without any preconception, what is this? It's a very open question, and it leads to a very expansive realization of what this is. When we are at our most open and our most accepting, there is nothing that is excluded from this. There is total interdependence and total interconnectedness with all that is. And that is a very freeing realization. My experience of Suzuki Roshi when I met him was as of someone, I mean, I couldn't have put it into words at the time. I felt completely received by him, completely accepted by him, just like this. I didn't have to come up to any mark. I didn't have to prove anything. I didn't have to do anything to impress him. He completely accepted me just the way I was. It didn't mean that he didn't give me a few pointers on some aspects of the form, for example, of a formal interview that I didn't know. But it didn't feel criticism. It just felt like information. It felt like teaching. And that kind of total openness to me was an entirely new experience and very refreshing and very inspiring. It seemed to me that he was able to accept everyone without exception. I mean, I felt loved by him, and I discovered over time, talking to other people, so did everybody else who hung out with him. How remarkable, you know. I want to be like that. How can he do that? You know. And it doesn't mean that he wasn't strict sometimes. It doesn't mean that he didn't correct people sometimes. But in correcting them or in being strict with them, he didn't stop loving them. And they didn't stop feeling loved by him. And that just seemed so amazing. And I was reading in one of these interviews with Joseph something that he said, which I highlighted, so where is it? He's responding to a question. Students new to the Buddhist tradition always seem to eventually ask the question, if all is emptiness, why is there compassion? How is it that this ethical quality is somehow built into the fabric of the universe? And Joseph says, for a few reasons, I think, but I want to bring up one in particular that I... He says, we can see compassion arising out of an experience of non-separation. As long as there remains a sense of self, the very notion of self predicates other. With the self, there is other than self. And other than self is everyone and everything else. And so the very notion of self carries with it implicitly the notion of separation. From the perspective of absence of self, there's no one there to be separate. So then it's just the interplay, the dance of elements, experience, phenomena. There's just the dance of all this, interconnected, interrelated, with a real sense of non-separation. And non-separation, I think, is another word for love. Again, it is not a matter of someone loving someone else, but goes beyond this to a simple manifestation of love. And I think that's what I experienced with Suzuki Roshi. The notion of a separate self had been worn away through 50 years of practice. I mean, he had been practicing 50 years when I met him. And if I should live so long, perhaps also I will have this rather constant experience of non-separation. I must admit that just now it comes and goes. But I am tremendously grateful for those moments when it comes, for those moments when there is no feeling of separation, when there is this feeling of boundarylessness and all-inclusiveness that is sometimes the gift of practice. And somehow I thought that this capacity of Suzuki Roshi to love everyone was just, you know, the byproduct of 50 years of practice. But a couple of months ago I was down at Tassajara for an event that we do every year where a number of old-timers come back for something called the No Race, where we run, walk, or crawl up the hill 5 miles and then come back, and or part of 5 miles, I never get to the top, and come back and have brunch together. But at that event, someone who'd been away for a while and is now back in the area was telling me about the first time he was at Tassajara in 1970, and Suzuki Roshi was teaching. And he was there as a guest student, as a short-term visiting student. We have programs where people can come for a week or more and just join in with the students working and sitting and practicing together. And so he was there as a guest student. He'd been there 4 or 5 days, and he had already felt loved by Suzuki Roshi. I mean, one of the things that we commented on was he was talking about this lecture that Suzuki Roshi gave, and he said, well, everybody in that room, I mean, I had felt loved by Suzuki Roshi, and I'd only been there 4 or 5 days. So everybody in that room had felt loved by Suzuki Roshi. And then he gave this lecture, and afterwards he said, there may be some questions. And one person raised his hand, and he said, Roshi, I've been practicing for 5 years now, and I don't seem to be getting anywhere. And Roshi said, oh, 5 years is nothing. You don't know how long it takes to love some people. Well, I was really struck by that, because what that meant to me was this capacity he had for loving everyone was not just a byproduct of practice. It was his practice. It was his practice. And that was such a wonderful thing to hear. Oh. So it takes a long time to love some people. So we have to work at it. It's our practice. Sometimes it takes a long time to love this one. Have any of you noticed that? No? When I told this story to someone just after I got back from Tassajara, that's the way she understood it, you know. It's taking her a very long time to find a way to love herself. And I think that's also at the basis of being able to love everyone, to be able to fully accept this one as it is. you know, we look so hard for someone out there to fully accept this one as it is. Partly we look hard out there because we're not able ourselves to accept this one as it is. So we keep looking, maybe someone else will do it. I had a friend of mine who practiced at Green Gulch with me when I was living there some years ago. And she said, she's also a therapist as well as a Zen practitioner, and she said to me, Blanche, if you don't want to take care of that pointy little kid inside of you, why do you give her to Lou to take care of? Why do you give her to me to take care of? Why do you give her to everybody else to take care of? Why don't you take care of her yourself? What's she talking about? But I began to explore that a little bit, and I began to see what she was talking about. You know? And I do think that some of our practice, you know, when you do loving kindness meditation, you begin here, right? You have to begin here. It's very hard to love others more than you love yourself. The way you can actually love everyone, as Joseph says, is when there's no difference, when everyone is included right here. But first it has to begin here. We have to begin by fully accepting this one as it is. And my feeling is, here we are practicing. When we, in our tradition, someone is chosen to be head student at Tassajara for each practice period. It's called Shuso, or head monk. And the first talk you give, it's called a way-seeking mind talk. It's about how did I come to practice? So you let all of the students in the practice period know something about your background and what were those elements of your life before practice that brought you to practice. It's such a rich way to get to know each other, actually, that now during every practice period we have each of the new students give maybe a 20-minute way-seeking mind talk, because it also helps people to consider, you know, how did I come to practice? What are those things in that conditioning in my life that turns me in this direction? But I was beginning by talking about my parents, my mother and my father, and what qualities they had and that I got from them, or what I had learned from them. And I don't know, I know that Gil has done a translation of the Diamond Sutra in his scholarly work, but I don't know if you've ever come across the Diamond Sutra in any of your studying. It's not so much in the Theravada tradition, I think. But there is this phrase that keeps coming up in there, a son or daughter of good family. If a son or daughter of good family were to take up this scripture, but one stanza of four lines and so. And I used to bridle at that son or daughter of good family because I thought it had to do with status of some sort, you know, caste or wealth or something. And so, you know, I come from the South where, you know, there are good families in the South, and, you know, and I wasn't one of them, right? I was from a little lower class than that. Anyhow, I bridled at this son or daughter of good family. In the middle of my way-seeking mind talk and speaking of my parents and how their influence, something of their influence had led me to practice, I said suddenly, oh, I'm a daughter of good family. A son or daughter of good family just means a son or daughter of a family that somehow leads you to practice, and here I am practicing. So I'm a daughter of good family. And so are you. Each one of you here is a son or daughter of a good family. You're here practicing the Buddha Dharma. How fortunate. There is nothing to regret. I mean, when I look at my life and see how much I appreciate my life at this moment, how can I regret anything that's happened in the past? It's sort of like, who this is, how this is, what this is a result of everything that's happened up until now. If anything were different, this would be different. So how could I have any regrets about what's happened in the past? There may be conditioning, there is conditioning that I still need to drop because there's still self-clinging comes up, you know, I feel it. But I am extremely happy to be here, to be alive, to be practicing the Buddha Dharma. How could I regret causes and conditions that brought me to this moment? So for me, that is just a tremendous freedom. I don't have to... There are very many things in the Zen tradition, poems and one thing or another, that have the line, don't waste time, you know, or don't pass your days and nights in vain. And someone came to me in an interview one day and said, what's wasting time? And I couldn't really think of an apt response. And then the next person that came in came full of recriminations about regrets about her past life or really more, what's the word I want? Senior moment here. anyhow, blaming a lot of people for the condition of her life. And I thought to myself, that's wasting time. You know, I didn't say to her exactly that's wasting time because it was somebody else who had asked me about wasting time. But I began to notice the things that people brought up with me in personal interview that seemed to me wasting time. You know, they're not paying attention to what's happening right here, right now. To appreciating this breath, to finding out how to live in this moment, they're raking over old coals, you know, and burning themselves again, every time. You know, that seems like a waste of time. So in any event, when I ran across this passage of Joseph's where he talks about non-separation, this experience of being connected with, interdependent with everything that is, of being boundarylessness, of being boundaryless. As a matter of fact, Kaz Ta-Nehisi, some of you may know him, has been working on a translation of the Heart Sutra, and the word, which is normally translated as emptiness, he has translated as boundaryless, or boundlessness, I guess, which is, I mean, I think that was done with great intention and great care. You know, we take a word like shunyata and we try to put it in English and to try to find a word that actually conveys what the Buddha was trying to convey when he spoke of shunyata. There's no exact English word that fits it. And the word emptiness is the one which has been used for years and years, so to put another spin on it gives us a little better feeling for what the Buddha might have been pointing at with the word shunyata. Boundlessness, emptiness. We say often, empty of own being, or empty of self. But when Joseph talks about the experience of emptiness of self is exactly compassion, that compassion is the function of living from that place. That this is what love is no separation. And Suzuki Roshi saying, it takes a long time to practice because it takes a long time to love some people. But isn't it worthwhile? Taking that time. Is there a better activity that I can spend my life on than learning to love everyone without exception? Than learning to completely embrace this life as it is. Because whether I embrace it or not, it is as it is. So either I find a way to embrace it and be content in it and to live it fully, or I find myself expending all of my energy fighting with it, wishing it were something else. And does that make it something else? Well, it makes it misery. But I don't have to do that. That's up to me. It was so instructive to me, actually quite transformative, to experience myself at one point in a long retreat at Green Gulch, going into the Zendo, feeling really very good. It was a beautiful, the kind of twilight in the early morning at Green Gulch, standing by the pond with a great blue heron across the pond. It's beautiful. And I came into the Zendo, I was feeling really expansive and wonderful, and I started sitting down. And I breathed, and some habitual thought came up of something missing in my life, something I thought was missing in my life. And I picked it up, and I started to go with it in my traditional, you know, my habitual pattern. And about 5 minutes later, I was feeling miserable, and I thought, whoa, wait a minute. I was feeling really great, and now I'm feeling really miserable, and nothing has happened. I've just been sitting here. I did that all myself. How did I do that? And then I started looking to see, how did I do that? And that was very, very informative to see myself sort of making up the story that made me miserable. And then seeing that so clearly, I realized that when the thought first arose, I have a choice. I can pick it up, and I can tell my usual story, you know, and end up feeling sorry for myself. Or I can see the thought arise and say, no, thank you. You're going to make me feel bad in about 5 minutes. I don't want to play today. And really bring the attention back to breath. Bring the attention back to sensation. Bring the attention back to what's happening now. And don't let it start romping around in all of this only what ifs, and if only I could, and why can't I, and isn't it sad, and well, you know, I don't know, you know your stories better than I do, but I bet you all know some stories, you know. And if you see one coming up and you don't want to go there, you have a choice. You have a choice. You can pay attention to that thought and start that whole process, or you can see it and say, no, thank you, been there, done that, don't care to today. Breath in, out. Come home to yourself and don't get caught in the story. I think I've been wandering around the map rather a lot. Maybe I should ask for questions and comments, and that will focus me at least on what you'd like to talk about. Yes?
Well, what if you find yourself clinging to the desire for the people you love and for all beings, really, to be free of suffering? How do you work with that clinging?
I think we work with that simply by practicing to free ourselves. There's a great quote in here from Joseph that I want to share with you, if I can find it. All right. Where he's talking about thinking of saving all beings and the Bodhisattva vow, you know. The question is, what models of awakening do you find most compelling? And he says, something that has been of increasing interest to me lately is the relationship of compassion and emptiness, or perhaps you could say wisdom and compassion, as the two core principles of the awakened mind. What I have been inspired by and what has transformed my own practice is a growing understanding that compassion and emptiness are not two different things. Compassion is not a stance, but is the simple responsiveness to circumstances from a place of selflessness. So it is not that someone becomes more compassionate. Rather, the emptier we are of self, the more responsive we are. And the questioner says, so it's a matter of getting out of the way so compassion can manifest itself? And he says, yes, exactly. Compassion is the manifestation of emptiness. And that feels very liberating and inspiring to me, because when I think of a self responding to all the suffering in the world, it feels too overwhelming. There's just too much suffering. How could a self hold it? It feels like the burden is just too immense. But when I think of compassionate action being the expression of emptiness, then it's not resting on the shoulders of anyone. It feels big enough to hold it all. And that's how I now understand the whole bodhisattva notion, the bodhisattva vow, in a way that makes sense to me. It's not a self. It's not someone doing it. It's just a natural manifestation. So when you think of yourself as responsible for the liberation of all beings, that's a big burden. But when you think of yourself as just manifesting a response to whatever appears in front of you out of a feeling of selflessness or out of an understanding of selflessness, then I think it's a different experience. I began my life in intense political activity, but sort of with the idea of I was going to save the world. It sounds a little bit like that. And I think maybe there are other people in this room who had that ambition to save the world, because you see, I mean, it's like the Buddha. He also had that ambition, right? And found that the only direction he could go was the direction of relinquishing self, relinquishing all clinging. And so you will find throughout the Pali Canon, you will find the Buddha saying something about not clinging. And not clinging even to good and wonderful things like the liberation of all beings. Yes? Is there a good clinging? There is not any clinging that is freedom. There are good things that we cling to, but the clinging in and of itself posits a self who is holding on to it, whatever it is. And the fact of the matter is, everything changes. There is nothing that we can hold on to that will not change. This is the mark of impermanence. And so any kind of clinging will lead to suffering, because nothing will stay the same. Well, it's sort of like that. So you cling to it, you suffer with it. It's like that, maybe. I think it's very important. You say, take what you want and pay for it. Brings up this whole notion of consequences of actions, the whole notion referred to normally as karma, although karma really means action. But when you really get it, that there is no action, no volitional action that you can take without the consequences coming along with it. That is, you can't choose an action and not choose its consequence. They come together. And when you get that, really, without doubt, then you choose your actions with care. You choose actions that don't lead to suffering. That's why some teachers, in the way they articulate the precepts, say, aware of the suffering caused by killing, I vow not to kill. Aware of the suffering caused by taking what's not given, I vow not to take what's not given, and so forth. the precepts are just about kinds of actions which inevitably lead to suffering. And so we want to be very awake in that realm so that we choose our actions carefully. Yeah?
Isn't that the truth that in the reality of life, some of the actions you have to take, and it's inevitable that the result is hard to take too?
Yes, and sometimes seeing that the result will be more suffering, we can sometimes find an alternative. But sometimes we can't. Sometimes we can't. That's why, you know, one teacher says in a way that I really appreciate, he says, our life is a life of vow and repentance. We make these vows, for instance, the Bodhisattva vow to save all beings, or any of the precepts. We make these vows. We do our best, we see our limitations, and we repent. And we, again, renew our vows. We do our best, we see our limitations, and we repent. So our life is continually vow and repentance. But we're always going in the direction of relinquishing clinging, in the direction of relinquishing self, in the direction of seeing our complete non-separation from all that is. Yeah.
You made reference to the special times when you don't feel the separation, you feel more or less no self. And I'm wondering how you could describe how that feels in terms of your interpersonal relationships. When you're in that place.
Well, in those times, there is, as I say, a feeling of the boundaries with which I define myself become less distinct, so that I don't have this strong sense of self. So that just whatever I'm doing with another person, it's just we're doing it together, and it's not my trip or their trip. It's just what we're doing. And it's not for me or for them, it's just what's happening. There's not a strong sense of some person in there who's either liking or disliking. I got a clock right in front of me. My friend back there is going time. Yes, and I think it is true. Maybe one more. Okay.
I hear sometimes the words good or bad or wholesome or unwholesome intentions, thoughts, actions. But that seems to imply then the clinging and aversions, preferences.
Mm-hmm. I prefer the use, I mean, I've heard also good or bad and wholesome and unwholesome. I prefer another translation of those same terms as skillful and unskillful, which I think has less of a sense of judgment to it. It's just what it's talking about is actions that tend toward liberation and freedom, or actions that don't tend toward liberation and freedom. And it's in that sense that there are actions that tend toward suffering and actions that tend toward freedom. Not so much judgmental as, you know, if you're skating on an ice pond and something says danger, thin ice, it's not judgmental. It just means if you go over there, you might fall in the water. And I have a little trouble getting out. Okay. Thank you.